is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. Rick, how's it going over there in Orlando?
I have started working on this grant, and this is a whole new thing. I did my first oral history because part of my grant is doing oral histories with the Winter Park Library. And some of my podcasting experience has worked, and some of it hasn't. It's hard. I want to ask yes and no questions just instinctively. And that, you know, I'm trying to be more open-ended with my questioning. So it's a learning process. But it's kind of fun because I think, you know, once you create this oral history and it's preserved, it's kind of, you know, preserved, you know, for future generations. And I like that idea. And I think I'm still inspired by, you know, the podcast we did last week with Ross Allen's daughter,
Betty.
The whole beauty of primary source materials, it's like, you know, I've always relied largely on secondary source materials. Now it's like I'm going straight to the source, and it's like, get out of my way. This is new. I want to do it. I just want to find people and talk to people about their original, you know, their unique experiences and stuff like that. So
I really appreciate primary research. Trained as a journalist, that's the only thing you're really allowed to do. I mean, you have to talk to the sources, and you always, you know, you're very cognizant of what other people write about their interview with a source is what they thought was important. It's not necessarily what you would find important or what that person, the subject of the interview, would find important. You know, I can't tell you the number of times I've interviewed somebody for a newspaper article, and they'll say, well, especially with features, well, they, you know, so-and-so wrote about me for this publication, but they didn't even mention this. Like what the interviewer finds interesting. It's really fascinating to me. I love oral histories. I loved in grad school, we had a choice between quantitative research and qualitative research methods. And quantitative research, to me, I'd rather have hot pokers shoved under my toenails than than do that. But, you know, qualitative research, I loved it. I love the ethnographies. I love doing oral histories. I wish there was more money in it, although it's not like I've chosen a career path that's far more lucrative than being a cultural anthropologist. I don't know why I say that. But I'm glad you're having fun, and I'm glad, you know, I really, really like the interviews we do on the podcast. I love our podcast when we do travel tips and things like that too, but especially when we have a good guest, which no pressure for this week's guest, but you know, you have a good guest. It just really makes it. And if you're listening and you have not yet listened to the episode we did last week with Betty Allen, Ross Allen's daughter, talking about growing up with reptiles, really go back and listen. Cause I think, that may have been our best one so far. I got so excited about that podcast.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, one of my biggest interests is Florida tourism history. And to have somebody who kind of grew up in that was
a piece of living history.
But I have to say, I want to build up our guest a little bit.
Right, right. No pressure for this week's guest, but you're just following the best ever.
She did a talk at Janine Taylor, who has since closed her gallery, which makes me sad, but she did it because she fell in love. And
wait, is that the one in Sanford?
Yeah, she fell in love. You know, she had been a widow for many, many years, and she fell in love, and her new boyfriend's whisking her away someplace. So it's very exciting. I'm sad that that place is going, and you know, I don't know if I'll ever show my artwork again. But Jennifer did a remarkable talk that I just thought was one of the best, you know, historical kind of presentations I've seen anywhere. And I was excited to get her on our podcast.
So when you say a historical presentation, this was probably about the history of Florida's governmental structure with as it relates to the Articles of Confederation, or was it more like a military strategy type of thing? Because I know our listeners love it when we talk about bureaucracy.
Yep, that's no circus history. And it was
even better.
It was remarkable. And, you know, I don't think that like circus is one of my favorite topics, but now I'm way more into it than I used to. And I love going to the Ringling because, you know, there's something of the, like that, the room with the big miniatures is just so idiosyncratic and small little pieces and parts. And I can totally, totally get into that.
So we should probably introduce our guest. Do you want to do the honors or shall I?
You. Because I forgot. Jennifer Lemmer Posey. Is that how you say it?
Okay, or you could do it. Hi, Jennifer Lemmer Posey. How are you?
I am wonderful, Kathy and Rick. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm already enjoying this. I love the style. I love everything that you've started out with: oral histories, cultural anthropology, even government and bureaucracy. All of these things cross into my world in all kinds of ways.
Well,
I'm really
excited
to be here.
If I have bureaucratic clown government on my bingo card today, are we going to hit that or not?
No.
In Thank
fact,
God.
I will have to redirect because as a representative who talks for, at times, the circus community, they don't love it when you compare them to what's going on in government because circus is on top of things and circus makes things happen.
So we should not call the current administration a three-ring circus? Is that woke? If we don't call them a three, I don't know anymore. I can't keep up. But now, first things first, are you a clown?
No, although I have to admit, I've gotten a little more energetic and I am, our listeners will not see this, but I use my hands a lot. So maybe I've started to pick up some of that clowning activity.
All right. But not in a bad way. We're not saying bad things about clowns.
No. I know many wonderful humans who are clowns, but I do not count myself as a performer in that regard.
For years, my sometimes live-in dog sitter, good friend of mine, was a clown. Actually worked with Feld Entertainment, which is down by you in Sarasota, and went on tour with some Disney show. He slipped on an inflatable tomato somewhere in Europe and had to come back home. And if you ever heard the phrase dancer's break and wonder how dancer's breaks happen, they don't just happen to ballerinas. They happen to people dressed like Eeyore who slip on an inflatable vegetable. So
you got to be careful around those inflatable.
No, but all that is a long way of saying I'm fascinated by all this because I grew up in Pinellas County. Most of my education was in Pinellas County. I love it here. And I love that Sarasota is so close, especially because I'm on the very southern end of Pinellas County. I can see Anna Maria Island, not from my house, but you know, I could see it from within a mile or two of my house. And I love going over the bridge because you've got this lovely Sarasota arts and culture thing. And then you have, you know, Selby Botanical Gardens and their whole thing. But then you've got this really interesting circus culture because I wrote a feature about the new Cirque du Soleil show in Orlando. And they brought in some of the performers to a Tampa venue for us to meet. And I started talking to one of the guys who played one of the owls. It's a whole thing. And he grew up in a Sarasota circus family. He had a little baby. He was married to another circus performer. And I said, are you going to teach the baby? And he was like, yeah, if they want to. And it's people think, oh, circus. And they immediately think, not immediately, a lot of people, they think about almost a carny-like atmosphere. But the actual culture of circus is fascinating to me because it's not something one does on a whim. You know, this whole idea of running away to join the circus, I've never seen that. What I've seen is my family has been in the circus for 9 generations, like that sort of thing.
Absolutely. So that idea of circus as a community and as a family, which is inherently international, is what has kept me here all these years. I had no circus background before I came to work at the Ringling Museum. I've learned it all here from the community, from you know, the performers and the people who make circus happen, and also those people who love it so much that they've helped save its history. And what I see is that dedication to the world, to the community of circus. And then we also really double down here at the museum on using the term circus arts because you know, truly circus is a performance art. And there is that gray line that in American imagination, for all kinds of great reasons, the circus is considered this kind of liminal space, maybe a little sketchy, a little, you know, that idea that it aligns with the carnival world. And yet when you look at it from the inside out, there's overlap, but they're really quite different in the way they move through the world and in the kind of dedication. You know, you have certain people within the carnival world who have multi-generations, but they tend to be the people that own it. Whereas circus families, as you're saying, I think even sometimes when they don't mean to pass down the performance gene, the performance art, it just happens because children grow up in this world where their parents are balancing on a rope. So why don't I try to do that? And it's beautiful to watch. I will add that just recently I was giving a tour to a group of performers, all of whom were first generation circus. So it's shifting in modern day, which notions of family are shifting in the modern day too, aren't they? So it's still the circus family, but you may be coming into it from training programs or from, you know, kind of building rapport with those who have been there longer. So it's growing in a unique way.
Is it still a big part of Sarasota's culture in this day and age?
You know, I'm finding that harder to answer because I am so immersed in it myself that my immediate answer is yes, of course. Obviously, it's everywhere you look. And it is. Now, how much everybody in Sarasota sees that, less clear. But right now, just out near the interstate, we have the Wonderland Circus that is being produced by Nick Walenda. The tent is up right there. You can see it off of I-75 as you drive by. When his tent comes down, the Circus Sarasota tent will go up in a nearby location, and that will be up January through March. At the same time, there are little tents popping up all over. We're at the beginning of the circus season, and many little shows launch out of Sarasota. So, and when it's not this time of the year and they're not on the road, these same families are here. And sometimes you run into them working in stores or working in the wardrobe departments of the theater. So to me, they are here and influencing our art scene, you know, in a way that is really palpable.
I'm processing because I had a thought and then I
interrupted. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's my thoughts sometimes are too, I want to say too complex, but that's not it. I was just thinking about the connection between the Sarasota arts culture that we think of with, I don't know how to say, this is my problem. I don't know how to say this without sounding like an asshole. You know, the arts, the black tie arts, and then the circus arts. I'm thinking about the intersect of that because I think sometimes people don't think of circus as art, but I think it's a very niche, skilled type of art.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I welcome that thought because it is something we're always kind of exploring, both at the museum and in Sarasota, really. When you look at the origins of circus, so I'm going to take you back into the weeds, forgive me. One thing that I think is really interesting, as someone who I studied as an art historian, I consider myself a cultural historian at this point. And I think it's marvelous that with circus and circus arts, as I say it, we have a definitive date of when the modern circus came into existence, 1768, outside of London, the very first circus as we consider it in modern day, and that is a performance in a ring with multiple types of acts, took place. So 1768, so we're a little bit past 250 years of circus.
That's not as long as I would have thought.
No, this is, you know, you have to consider that's the organized form where we're producing a program that has these varied disciplines, all of which existed before: equestrian, riding, acts, juggling, contortion, all of these kinds of performances predate that. But, you know, this presentation starts there in a riding school. So the circus starts actually with horse acts and in permanent venues in Europe. And that's a really significant piece of it, because the European notion of circus, my European friends who do circus history tell me that when I say circus arts, I'm being redundant, because they culturally, many Europeans accept the circus as a performing art form. They would dress to go to Cirque du Verre in Paris the same way they would dress to go to the opera. And that's changed with contemporary times, as all art forms have. But the notion in Europe is circus is an artistic expression. Here in the States, circus started out in purpose-built venues. The first circus, Ricketts Circus, was in Philadelphia, was right next to what served as the Hall of Congress at the time, hosted a dance for George Washington's birthday. It goes back to that bureaucratic and the connections, but it was high society at that point in time. And then it started traveling under tents and moving from town to town, which business-wise was great because they didn't need to change their program frequently. They changed their audience. It kind of shifted the balance. And then I could go through long weeds there, but basically you get to Barnum. I'm pretty sure it's always Barnum that makes things both wonderful and difficult, because he really had a vision to commercialize circus. He really knew how to market things. And in doing so, and in growing the circus, because with partners, he's really responsible for going from a one-ring intimate performance space into this three-ring extravaganza that, you know, is in a town for one day and then jumps to the next town. So becomes this commodity. Instead of really focusing on the artistry in front of you, you're focusing on the whole big spectacle. And that's where it starts to shift in American imagination, that, that the circus is more experiential, a little more aligned with amusement parks and those kinds of things. And yet the people and animals, the performances in the rings are still the same kind of artistry. They're just, amidst the backdrop of so much else. So American circus, I always like to say that, I think there's a global sense that Americans always have to kind of be big and over the top. And I think that Barnum did that to us, right? Like with things like the circus that he exported.
I'm so, just the culture around circus. I remember being, I don't know how old I was, but the Ringling Brothers Circus used to come to the now defunct Bayfront Center in St. Petersburg. And I think I might've gone a handful of times, if that. And I could not, for my part, get past the animals. I was heartbroken for all the animals. But that's a very small part of circus, and that's changing too, is it not?
It is. The fewer and fewer circuses travel with animals at all. And I'll say, more than 20 years in here working at the museum and working with the circus community, and the question of performing animals is complicated in a lot of ways. But what I have seen time and again is that those performers and those families that have worked with animals for years and years have built such beautiful relationships of trust and knowledge with the animals that they work with. That my take as a circus historian is that the level of knowledge and concern that we can now feel for animals, the awareness of the degree of empathy that so many animals are capable of, this idea that we are more familiar with their intelligence and their emotional well-being, starts in a sense with circus, because people are living with these animals and getting to know them. And in an era before there were zoos, and certainly before there was media culture that we can get information, the circus was taking animals all across the country and people were seeing them for the first time. So, I try to avoid kind of projecting my values of today backwards. And I don't want to brush over the fact that there were certainly people who did mistreat animals. That, the history isn't pure and clean and golden, but what I've seen time and again in the community is this mutual respect that I think actually fed where we are today in our understanding. There were the positive parts of it for its early history. Today, what circuses by and large are seeing is that audiences are really fascinated by what people can do, and that, caring for animals and traveling with them, even aside from whether or not public sentiment, because it's really a 50-50 out there in the world of how people feel about it. But the cost of licensing animals and, you know, making sure that they're well fed and that they're traveled safely is so exorbitant that that also is prohibitive for circuses. And again, human talent and combining that with technology, you see, you know, the use of first it was motorcycles and bicycles. And now, you know, the Ringling, the newest Ringling show has had the robotic dog. So they find these fun ways to kind of integrate what's current into the world. And that has made the need for performing animals for audiences a little less palpable anyway. I was all over the place with that. I'm sorry. I have like wide feelings on that history. But again, I can't say enough, you know, the beauty of the relationships that I've witnessed of people who work that closely with animals.
It's a tough, tough topic. You know, I had a friend, a good friend who was a graphic designer like me, and she worked for an agency and they had the Ringling account and she wouldn't work on it because of the animal issue. And it's so intermeshed. But I think about, you know, the contemporary circus experiences I have, which is really Cirque du Soleil, there's no animals involved at all. And, you know, you don't really miss them. You know, it's such a, you know, it's all technology, you know, like mountain bikes and skates and stuff like that. And people, for the most part, are the main part of the show.
You don't miss them at all in Cirque du Soleil because you're too busy trying to figure out what the hell's going on in the story. Animals would just make that far more complicated.
It's true. That would be another layer.
I never bothered trying to trace the narrative. I just enjoy what's going on.
The one they have at Disney Springs right now is the only one I've ever been able to follow the story. And it's because they are telling the story of a young girl, a fictionalized story, through they call it a love letter to Disney animation. You as a graphic designer might actually really appreciate it, but it's she's processing her grief and having all these memories of her father, and it's the only reason I can follow that story. And even then, but it's, I mean, I love it. You're right, you don't almost don't know, you don't need a story.
No.
Cirque du Soleil is an extreme type of circus, and it is a testament to what both the human body can and should never do on a repeated basis.
I would say that, though, the part of the testament to what the human body can and perhaps should not do is one of the things I just love about the whole history of circus, though. We have this marvelous poster in the collection for a performer named Hilary Long. He was with the Ringling Show in, I want to say, around 1918. I don't know the exact date off the top of my head, but Hilary Long was the man who walked downstairs on his head. This is what the poster shows, is this, you know, and it's, of course, it's a still image. It's a poster. And so they have him at the top, and then there are these little dotted lines going down the steps, and then he's at the bottom.
Did he have arms?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, he had arms and legs. He just went down. Like, that was his skill, is he could balance. And then stop and think about it, to be able to balance on your head, not even just your arms, well enough that you can then bounce down steps. Like, I mean,
is that
why
good?
Did he ever
is that
try it?
Good but, for whoa. Your frontal lobe?
No.
It's like a series of mini concussions with every step.
I mean, I just feel like I'm not worried about football players anymore. Now I'm worried about circus performers.
And just think, do you kind of just fall off the step, or do you actually kind of spring up and down?
What muscles do you have in your head that push the step?
Makes my neck hurt.
Yeah. Well, it always boils down to me was like, what made him try that? Like, where was the first moment that it was like, oh, I bet I could do that? And that's just one example. There's many, I mean, flying trapeze and people who are like, can I do four somersaults in the air before I catch? Like, you know, and I can see where a progression leads to trying that, but I'm still amazed that humans can do it.
Yeah.
I read this book a couple years ago called The Orphan's Tale. And it's about a woman who, it's about a traveling circus in Europe in World War II. And there's some pretty horrific things in the book, but the trapeze artist, which is not the point of the book, not the most horrific thing to most people, but just the description of the performance in this book, it was enough to make me a little nauseous, if that makes sense. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of things that are up high.
Okay.
So I, you know, I can watch the trapeze acts. I don't love watching them. They make me a little nauseous. not because I don't think they're incredible or anything like that, and not that this is the point of the podcast, but even reading the book was a lot. I get vertigo on escalators.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're out there wondering, how do I kill Kathy Celestri? I just gave it to you right there. So
I'd have to redact that bit of it.
But. Chad, edit that out. You know what I was thinking about is I've seen these images. I thought of them are from Europe, of these giant, they're almost like puppets, like of giant creatures like mastodons and mammoths and elephants in some cases, where, you know, people are manipulating them and making them walk. Have there been any circuses that have kind of replaced, you talked about the mechanical dogs, replaced the animals with puppetry and different ways of having that existence, but not having the actual animal?
There have been a few different shows that have done that with some puppetry and holograms as well. And the theatrical version of the book, Water for Elephants, which that was published like a decade or more ago now, and has been produced as a play that used puppets for the animals. So there's been a little bit of that, I think. And I feel like I'm speaking for the circus world here, and I actually should not, but my sense is generally that is a weird gray area to go into puppets as animals, like either have animals or don't. You know, like if it's really beautifully done spectacle of puppetry, then that has its own aspect to it. But if you're just putting it in there to, you know, try and have an elephant walk across, that seems more to irritate audiences than.
Yeah, I get that. I was just thinking of it in terms of another art form that, you know, as the, you know, like Cirque du Soleil is a great example. It shows the expansion of what circus can be, you know, that maybe, you know, you can incorporate different things. And I mean, I think that's the one of the things that I really loved about the first time I saw Cirque is that, like, circus can be this. I never thought about that before.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a wonderfully adaptable form. I mean, I pointed to that beginnings and it starts with the horse at the equestrian school. But circus has always just absorbed anything. Anything that can be of interest, can be entertaining or a spectacle, and then adapted. I mean, that's the other side of it for all of these kinds of things. You have to take that art form and figure out how you can make it travel efficiently, you know, so puppetry, and that's not, it's certainly not beyond the realm, but it's the idea of like, how do you make it durable enough and quick enough that it can be like put up between one act and another. So the amount of flexibility and innovation that's involved in creating a new kind of circus act, I think is what keeps it exciting for people. Because anything can be circus. You just have to figure out how. And on the flip side, Kenneth Feld, who has now retired from Feld Entertainment, he once said to me, and I've heard him say this in other venues, that circus just ekes out into the world. So, you know, now we have yoga studios that do aerial yoga. We have, you know, all these different ways, all of the Super Bowl events that now incorporate these kind of spectacles that start with circus. So it comes and goes, you know, from the classic circus ring into all these other areas of culture, which keeps it relevant, even in moments where it's maybe not as much on the popular culture radar.
Can I change the tact for a minute? Because I have some Florida specific questions.
Sure.
So the Sarasota area is thought of as the winter home at one point of the circus, but now it's clearly so much more. First of all, why this area? Do you have any knowledge as to why Ringling chose this particular area?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I love it. So we now like to call Sarasota the epicenter of the American circus because, you know, internationally we are, it's interesting. You can travel abroad and anyone who knows circus knows about Sarasota, which isn't necessarily the biggest city in Florida that people are aware of, right? But, and that relationship goes all the way back to 1927 and really earlier than that. So where I am sitting right now is on the estate of John Ringling, who was the youngest of the five Ringling brothers that started the circus. And later in his life, John started really doing the work of investing in railroads and real estate. And He came to Sarasota with his wife, Mabel. They purchased this property to become a winter residence. And John very quickly got into developing the Sarasota area. So this is during the Florida land boom of the 20s. And he's investing in real estate out on the barrier islands. He and his brother, Charles, both are investing in the downtown area. And really, really building up Sarasota as a place to come and to winter. And, then through a series of things, the land boom busts, and John is still really focused on building up the region. He is at that point the last of the Ringling brothers. So while he had very good management, you know, he is the king of the circus world. He owns the biggest circus in the country and very quickly actually buys up a lot of competitors. And he made the decision in 1927, actually 1926 for 1927, to bring the winter quarters for Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey from Bridgeport, Connecticut, where it had been since 1919, down to Florida. And there were a lot of reasons for this. That, you know, one thing was that a winter quarters in Bridgeport, Connecticut is not quite as operational, perhaps, as one in Florida, where you're not buried in snow and ice. So, you know, functionally, it was a good move. In the era before it came to Sarasota, the performers might not have stayed around the winter quarters. The winter quarters was really where the show logistically went back to rebuild. But with Sarasota, he created, like, he made accommodations available for performers. It made it more comfortable with the eye to making the winter quarters here publicly accessible. So early Florida tourism, you know, something that people could go out and see the spectacle of the circus when it was here. He's moved people into town. He's moving all kinds of artistic talents into town, people helping to, you know, create the circus, to envision, choreograph, all of these things. So he's bringing all of this attention in. He's selling land because people need places to live. He's, you know, like, in all ways, this kind of shores up the economy and is an attraction. So it served these multiple purposes for him. And for us, what it meant is that the circus community came, and because it wasn't snow and ice and because they could practice their acts outdoors, they moved here to Sarasota. And it's, you know, it's blossomed out to all of Sarasota County and even a little beyond, you know, the reach of that community. But it comes down to the idea that it's Florida, and in the winter, you know, you can do wonderful things anywhere you want. So he did an ad campaign, Ringling did, in the first years, 27, 28, with the circus program, but also a tourist event at Madison Square Garden with these wonderful graphics that said, spend your summer this winter in Sarasota, Florida. So that was where it started in terms of the winter quarters. Circuses had been coming to the state prior to that, although not deep into Florida. The economy wasn't necessarily supporting big shows coming and moving at the pace that they did. So Ringling really changed that.
Okay. And the, so how is there a tie-in between the winter home, spend your summer in the winter? I like that. I like that a lot. Is there a tie to the circus being here and then the international showmen, the retired carnival workers who are, mm-hmm. what, because they're not right next to each other. They're what, the Ruskin area, right?
Yeah, Gibsonton.
Gibsonton. Exactly.
Is there a relationship? And if so, what type?
There's absolutely a relationship. It's, you know, it's a blend between, and I'm trying to think back of it. I have to admit my history on Gibtown and the Showman's Club there is not.
We should really send people a cheat sheet before they come on the show. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm good. I know enough to get myself probably in trouble, but you know, they have a museum there too, the Showman's Museum. It's so much fun. Anyway, that community really does start in part because of the Ringling show coming down here. So, you know, some of the performers with the Ringling Sideshow settled in that area. Because sideshow and carnival are a little more closely aligned in the world of allied arts to the circus. So because they would travel different routes when they weren't with the circus and different venues. And so that built up with the carnival community. And I think there's a parallel in time a little bit later than the Ringling Show with the carnival people coming in, but much the same kind of reasoning that, you know, you can do the work. And when you think about carnival and building out the rides, you know, the things that they do up in Gibsonton, you drive up there and you see all these rides parked off to the side, you know, folded down. And all of that was much more viable to be done outdoors and to be ready, because the heart of winter is really when shows want to be at home retooling, because that's not when you're going to get the crowds. So you have to be in a space that you can do that work. And just to circle back to the kind of the community aspect, there's a showman's club in Gibsonton that is, you know, really like the population there is more leaning towards the carnival industry. There is a showman's club or the show folks club here in Sarasota, which is more specifically the circus community, but they blend together. I mean, the communities know one another very well, and many, many people identify or participate in both clubs. So that world is very much overlapped, even though the business models are a little different.
Okay.
So is that open to the public? I mean, are those just for performers to hang out, or like the club?
Oh, the clubs. You have to be a member, although there are certain times of the year that they're open for various things. So World Circus Day is in April. I think it's the third Saturday of April every year. And generally the Sarasota Show Folks Club is open at that point in time. And they'll have members there showing maybe some of their costumes or talking about their history, all of the rooms are lined with photographs. So if you're really lucky, the first time I ever went in there, a member of the Willenda troupe, an older member, took my hand and walked me around and pointed out every person he knew in the room. It was magical. So there are moments where public can get in. And in Gibsonton, I know when they have in February, they do the big international trade show for carnival, which I have yet to make it to that, but you can buy day passes to that and see like the rides that are coming out. And I believe the club is open at that point. And then the museum that's there is its own property. And I think right now is just open on weekends.
Well, there's a carnival museum. There's the exactly. Showman's Museum.
Yeah, it started out with the title of the International Showman's Museum, but I think they're now really doubling down on it being Carnival World or Carnival Museum. And they're doing a great job of keeping the artifacts that they have up there. It's been a collection that's been built out of the community, and the museum is run out of that community. So they're doing great things.
It's a lot, and I think people confuse the two, which is why I wanted to definitely.
Yeah.
The difference here.
Yeah.
That's a big question for me. The Ringling Museum is something quite different, where, you know, it was established by John as a museum of art, and the Circus Museum was added at a later date. But we do the history of the circus, and when people come in, one of the first things they want is, you know, where are the weird bodies? Where are the, and we have pieces of that. We have some of the wagons that have banner line images for the sideshow on the Ringling Midway. Those are on display. And we have a really deep collection that looks at that experience of variable bodies, of different bodies from the 16th century on within our print collection. So we get into that side a little bit, I guess, in a little more of an academic way, talking about some of the lessons that we're learning out of the arena of scholarship that's doing disability studies, and using phrases like variability, which is like, I think is the most amazing thing, because it's talking about the fact that every one of us has a body that's different. And so it puts a spectrum of, you know, the bodies of people who are born with physically, you know, obvious disabilities are on a spectrum with someone who is, you know, a flying trapeze artist who has this exceptionally toned body. We all just have these different experiences. So we're trying to welcome our visitors in a way that, you know, does acknowledge that they assume sideshow is part of this story, but using it to then kind of get back to the heart of what our collections are, which is circus.
Wow.
Yeah, I just went all over the place. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, I never thought about it in that way, you know, because, you know, I when I I like that kind of sideshow aesthetic. You know, obviously my artwork kind of leaned in that direction because, you know, one of the things that attracts me to circus is the whole aesthetic. You know, I love the big woodblock type posters you have on display at the museum. You know, it's colorful and it's offbeat. And, you know, that's the part I like, but also, but when you think about it, it, you know, it could be very derogatory to people, you know, that are on display. So how did the performers feel about that? You know, who, you know, were performers in sideshows? I mean, is it hurtful to them?
Well, I mean, first, truly, we don't have a lot of primary sources. I mean, we'll go right back to where the opening was, right? And the actual stories of the people, we have a lot of publicity. Yeah. You know, we have a lot of the storytelling that shows give. So you always have to take that with a grain of salt. But that said, one thing we have in our archives here, which I think is just such a lovely treasure, is a scrapbook that was made by a man named Charles Tripp. Charles Tripp toured with the Barnum and Bailey show in the very early 20th century. He was part of the group that went abroad to Europe with Barnum and Bailey for the sideshow. Charles Tripp was born without arms. And he was presented within their sideshow, and he did these scrapbook cuttings. And the book that we have is actually one he made for his mother, where he cut scrap paper and pasted it into this book and wrote information about family members next to photographs, all using his feet.
Wow.
And in the back of that book are the pictures, or just a few pictures that he took while he was on this European tour. And so Charles Tripp, born in, you know, the Northeast of America without arms in the, I don't know his dates exactly, but, you know, let's say the 1880s, what would life have been? What other course would have taken him to Europe? You know, meeting crown heads of state, all of these kinds of things. For him, I can see that this was a blessed life. It worked out, you know. So there are these moments that you see where there was somebody found the right home for themselves and a community that accepted them for who they were, because everybody was different. There are counter stories to that. We have I'm losing all my names today, but you know, there were many performers who were taken in their youth from families and presented. So all of that's complicated, but that's one reason I started talking with a group of scholars who was doing disability studies, because many of them themselves identify as disabled in one form or another. And they've been very interested in our archives, and, you know, again, looking at prints of variable bodies for centuries as kind of like their history. And they said that, you know, it's dangerous if you hide this too much, but, you know, because we don't want to risk erasing the history of disability. And also, there's a chance to understand how this was perceived 200 years ago, which might not be in the same way that it has been, you know, more recently. So anyway, it's all of that. Again, I'm getting into the weeds, but it's what I love about my job with the circus, is that all of these different stories weave in and out, because it's all a story about culture, about who we are, what we're interested in, you know, what gets pushed out as the spectacle that we consume in any given era.
What I loved is your talk in Sanford is how you ended with, you know, go see a circus, and you had the dates of all the circuses all over the state. And I have to say, it's kind of dropped off my radar because I wasn't aware any of that stuff was going on anymore. And that, you know, now I've seen it pop up since you've kind of created that awareness that, you know, you can go out there still and experience it today in Florida.
Yeah, on all these different scales. In my galleries, sometimes I'm walking through and I'll hear a visitor say, "Oh, it's too bad there's no more circus." And I have to watch myself and not get too aggressive because I stomp my feet. And I'm like, but there's so much circus out there. But you're right, it's harder to find. I mean, you know, in this day and age, we're flooded with all the different things. Think about all the events that are on social media and all the great things that one should go out and do. It becomes overwhelming. And so if you're not already tuned in to circus, it's easy to miss it. And I think that the American conception of circus relies so much on the name brand of Ringling that individuals, especially with Ringling going off the road in 2017, and now they're back. I mean, they'll be starting their tour here in Tampa at the very beginning of the year. But a lot of Americans think that if it's not the Ringling show, then it isn't circus. And yet there are all these little tented shows, one ring shows, stage shows that are touring different parts of the country. And it's, to me, those shows, those businesses are really going back to the roots of circus, where it was a little more driven by the performers wanting the venues like to do their acts. So you get Kevin Venardos was a ringmaster for Ringling for many years, and he now runs the Venardos Circus, which is it's a small circus, but he just has to perform, and he's assembled a lovely cast of performers with him that feel the same way, and they work really hard to make a go of it. So we see these different ways that circus is still kind of chasing its own roots, but through a different experience for people. So it's always my big call to action is go see a circus, like pick one out and just go, because it's amazing what people do.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I will add to that not only should you go see a circus, but please, everyone, be more mindful when you use circus and clown as pejoratives.
Thank you. The circus community will appreciate that.
I just never thought of it. Wow. This has been eye-opening, and the time has flown by. And thank you so much for being on the podcast. We're going to put in our show notes a list of links, and I've gotten a few, but if you could send us, just so people can find this episode, if you could send us that picture of the man going down the steps on his head.
Absolutely.
Really, really would love that. That would be great.
Yeah, it's a big thing now. We're actually soliciting pieces of art for the little photograph for each episode. We did that last week too. It's like, find a picture of yourself with an alligator in a bathtub. Now, that's our whole goal.
I can see why you would want that one. Absolutely.
Yeah, you talked about it. I got to see it.
Yeah, I think our listeners deserve to see it.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Before we go, we want to thank our active supporters. We have a new supporter this week. Shout out to Sean Coulter, who has supported the podcast just a few days ago. We also want to thank Kelly Sturdy, Stephanie Hewley, Brad Sager, Brian Woodall, Bet's Boys Adventure, Elise Smith, Carol Miller, Davida Breyer, Natalie Zachrick, Angela Connolly, John Bowne, and Ryan Worthington. And if you are on that list and you are not getting at least postcards from us, maybe more, depending on how much you support, what level of support you offer, please make sure that I have your mailing address. We do send out an automated email once we add you to our list, but a couple of you are missing out on some really cool stuff. Anyway, you too can support the podcast for as little as $3 or $5 a month and as much as $10, depending on what level you support at. Depends on how often you receive little freebies and gifts. All you have to do is go to floridaspectacular.buzzsprout.com and then go ahead and look for the Florida Splaining Club and click support. You can Florida Splain along with Rick. And today we all circus splained. So Jennifer, thank you for circus splaining with us. That was wonderful.
It's been so much fun. Thank you for inviting
me
here.
And we will see you all next week on the Florida Spectacular.
Bye.
Bye.